Welcome to Cattle HQ, a podcast from industry experts and progressive producers discussing cutting-edge info about the cow-calf sector to keep cattlemen and women in the know and positively affect their bottom line.
On today's episode of Cattle HQ, we're going to be visiting with Dr. Saul Ozoka from University of Tennessee. He is an extension beef specialist, and he is new to the podcast this year, and so we're excited to bring him back, but he is not new to SDSU. So Dr. Saul got his PhD up here in Brookings with Dr. George Perry a few years ago, and recently has joined the faculty at University of Tennessee. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Taylor. Very happy to be here. I did actually some work with Dr. Julie Walker that is still there at South Dakota. I did a year of postdoc with her after I finished my PhD with George Perry. And we all know when George moved to Texas A&M, Julie actually took me over. So actually was co-advised by both of them. So yeah, being very, very fortunate to know South Dakota very well and traveling and visiting producer there, learning about extension with both of them. I think they're really great people, really great program in extension that has helped me a lot on this new position I am here in University of Tennessee.
Right. Yeah, two great mentors to get you into extension, because sometimes it can be hard to know, you know, how to make those connections or what producers want. And so you had some good background here in South Dakota, but then you found somewhere warmer to go live, hopefully. So that's never a bad thing. We're easing up on some really cold weather at the end of this week. So hopefully it'll warm back up into December, but you never know. And so as you've started your new role down there, bull fertility has kind of been a topic of interest. I know that's kind of been growing, I would say, in the last 5 years. You know, the female fertility is really important as well, but really honing in on more of our bulls, because we have to get cows bred, whether that's natural service or AI. So why don't you give us a little bit of background on the extension and research you're currently doing at UT?
Absolutely. If you don't mind, I'm going to give a little extra background there. So I started actually working on bull fertility and semen quality when I was a student in Brazil. So I'm originally from Brazil, and I got a DVM in Brazil, and so I worked actually with water buffalo and looking at some semen quality, and that really sparked a little thing in me for the research side and also for the male fertility. And with that, I actually got an opportunity to come to the U.S. to do an internship with Dr. Joe Dalton at the University of Idaho. And started working with him, and we had a project, or he had a project, to continue working and looking into male fertility. And with my interest in male fertility, that was a really nice connection there. So that's how I ended up doing my master's project and coming back to the U.S. for a master's program at the University of Idaho. In that project, actually, we looked into the insemination doses. So we had some, going back at that time, and so that was around 2014, 15, when we started looking at these things. And there's a lot of advertisements saying more semen is better, more semen is more fertility, more pregnancies. And we're like, well, is that really true, or is that just a marketing strategy, right? So we look at it in my master's. We look at between 10 million to 40 million sperm per insemination dose, which is basically the current commercial doses for conventional semen. And in reality, we saw, and we did bred about 5,000 cows in Brazil with that study. And there was no differences between 10 to 40 million. So we used 10, 20, and 40 million. And we actually used two different 20 million doses in there, varying only in the color of these trials we were inseminating the cows. And the numerical difference we saw between the two 20s was nearly identical to what we saw between the 10 and 40 million doses. So in reality, we have taken a hold of this, and what we put in these trials, when we think about quantity of semen, is enough to get the cows pregnant. That is the take-home message from there. And interestingly, as we keep looking at the data, well, we had five bulls, but the fertility of those bulls, even though we wanted them to be very similar, it was not. So we start seeing differences in fertility between those bulls. And we saw some bulls out of those five, basically two bulls were high fertility, two bulls were low fertility, and we have one that was basically the average fertility of the group. And we started digging more into semen quality. And that's where I started digging further into my interest in fertility markers and trying to figure this out. Because I was like, well, it'll be better if we could eliminate these bulls before they even get out, right? So we did a bunch of analysis, fancy analysis. We look at, okay, let's put this on a, so there's a machine called a computer assisted sperm analysis, so our CASA for short, that you can look at the motility there very objectively. It's all measured. You can look at velocity of sperms, a bunch of different things, and also a flow cytometer that allows us to look at each individual sperm, and we can look at about 5,000 sperm per sample, which is a lot of sperm in each analysis. And we did several different analyses there, and her conclusion was, well, even though we see these differences in fertility in the field, even after doing all this analysis, we cannot explain the difference. I was like a little frustrating, but I was like, okay, so there is more that we need to keep digging and figuring it out. So as I was finishing my master's, I was like, well, I do like research. I want to continue doing this. So I'm going to do a PhD. And I joked to this day with my master's advisor because I told him, well, I'm from Brazil. I came to Idaho. It's a little cold for me. I'd like to move a little south. And I started moving, and then we finally find Dr. Perry's name in South Dakota. And I went visit and this and that, and I finally got my position to start with George there. And then I go every time I see him, and I tell him, you know, South Dakota has South only in the name, right? It's as cold or actually colder than Idaho, right? But I mean, it was really good experience for me. I learned a lot in a really good lab. So when I moved to South Dakota to work with Dr. Perry, he actually had me working on the male. Our lab technician at the time, Stephanie Perkins, was working on some male fertility as well. And then we had the rest of the group basically working on female, which helped me expand my knowledge, right? Continue working on both sides, which we know, like you said, both of them are important, right? So even though I focus my research on the male side, we understand the need for the females, right? And that's why probably a lot of the research in the back focus on the female, because we could have a lot larger impact thinking about the number of females compared to the number of males we use. And now that we have moved the needle so far with the females, we are now starting looking in the males. So now move me to South Dakota, where I start keeping looking into male fertility with Dr. Perry. And we did several different things. I have several different projects there. But the first one, we're looking into the proteins of the sperm and the fluids and looking at how that impact the longevity of sperm. One of our question was, hey, we know, in the epididymis there, right there in the testes, that sperm lives for weeks. And then after ejaculated, it may 24, 30 hours and it's all dead. So what is going on in these two environments that makes the sperm live so much shorter, right? And we look at the proteins, and we were able to find some things related. There are some proteins. I'm not gonna go in much detail here, but and the pH is different that also impact the sperm motility and all that between the sperm. Within that study, we saw several different proteins, and I started looking, digging into the function of those proteins. And because of my interest in male fertility, I was like, well, is there any protein here that could be a fertility marker for these bulls? So I started looking different samples there, trying to validate and looking for those proteins. So I did many different trials and errors there, and I found actually three proteins that I start looking closer, and the commonality between the proteins were they are associated to cell-to-cell interaction. So that cell-to-cell is extremely important for fertilization. So when the sperm connects to the ovum, the uterus, the ovum, the oocyte for actual fertilization, all that is somewhat mediated by proteins. So I was like, well, these three proteins may be that there may be something to it. So I started looking further into those proteins. Two of those proteins, we saw that there was no relationship to the fertility we were looking into. Again, a bummer, but it's good to know that okay, there's difference in the amount of those proteins between bulls, but they're not really associated to the level of fertility of those bulls. And then there was one other protein that actually we saw a difference in a different study with. So the first one I'm talking about is with beef bull or dairy bulls, and the second one I'm going to talk now is with beef bulls. And
And
interesting thing,
was these semen from AI sired
yeah,
or just
all frozen semen from AI companies. So we
okay.
had the dairy bulls coming with the high and low SCR rates from the dairy industry. And then our beef bulls actually came from my master's trial. We still had semen available from those bulls that we knew were high, low fertility with almost 1,000 insemination per bull. So we were confident the data we had, and then started looking. And not only looking at that protein specifically, we're like, well, there's some old studies or observations, and that shows that some bulls, when they go through that capacitation, so the process that the sperm goes to actually be able to fertilize the oocyte, there's differences between the rate that they go or the ability of them to do that in vitro. And I was like, well, what if we start investigating this and see if there is any relationship? So we used this semen from the bulls we knew fertility, and started doing this in vitro capacitation. So looking again at several different flow cytometry analysis, looking again at that CASA analysis, and adding this one of these proteins into this test, and then looking very closely there. So long story short, bulls that are higher fertility in that study, they actually were more resistant to make, for lack of better word, they're slightly more resistant to that capacitation. So as time go by, we still had more bulls that are more, sorry, more sperm cells that were not capacitated compared to the low fertility bulls. So in general, we'll have more sperm within that ejaculated of those high fertility bulls that maintain that non-capacitated status compared to that low fertility bull, which was very interesting there. And we can dig into it if you want to talk more about it in details. But that protein that I was talking about is called CD9 protein. So that protein, the interesting thing about it, that protein is present in the oocyte. And there is studies that show that that protein is actually required for fertilization. So when they knock out that protein, so that protein wasn't present in the oocyte, the sperm could not fertilize the oocyte. So we're like,
Okay.
well, that protein is present in the sperm. So is there a function? Is that similar? So the interesting thing is the amount of that protein was not different between fertility groups. But what we saw is as we keep inducing capacitation of those bulls and look at overall, the low fertility bulls had more sperm that died and had that protein expressed compared to the high fertility bulls. And it's interesting because usually we don't look at the dead population. We are always interested on the population that has the higher fertility potential. But because we're incubating this, we thought, well, that might be a case where the dead is telling a tale, right? We're still not 100% sure why that happened, but then that's where further research is needed to look at more bulls, right? We have only five bulls, so that's something we're trying to add on to this data set and keep digging into, try to validate some of these studies.
So if
So that
they're
is.
more resistant to capacitation, they were living longer in the system to be able to be more fertile when they meet up with the oocyte.
Yeah, I think that that's a good statement there. So basically, they will have a lot. My hypothesis, they're probably having a larger window where they can fertilize the oocyte because there's some sperm capacitating, some that are still resistant to it. So we can have a larger window where the lower fertility, probably the window is narrower. So especially with those females that take a little longer to ovulate, and all that was bred based on fixed time AI. So
Right.
probably that window for those bulls is a little longer, which helps them have a higher fertility.
Okay. Yeah, I think that makes sense. So also in your time up here, you got to help with several AI schools. And so we just wrapped up one last week, and it was a good reminder of, those timing of insemination, right? Like when we're training kids not only on the process of AI, but the timing. And like you mentioned with fixed time AI, that window is fairly wide because you're trying to hedge the whole group at the same time to utilize, advantages of, less labor and less heat detection. And so these type of things would be really important because when we say 12 hours post standing estrus, we all know that's different. And then especially this time of year when it gets dark so early, it's pretty hard to heat detect at night when it's dark. So if we were able to identify these bulls that have higher fertility, and I think, like you said, you're kind of getting there with this study. There's several other indexes and, companies that kind of have some, fertility markers on which bulls might be better for fixed time AI. Are they looking at similar things, or are those kind of more based off of, actual breedings, like 1,000+ matings and the fertility, kind of like you started with your first project, like they're basing that off of the actual preg rates that they received back from exposure to these bulls?
Yeah, so you're correct. It's based on pregnancy coming back.
Okay.
So similar to what the dairy industry have done with the SCR being pregnancies, and we are getting some of this data back. And the reason it's so much harder for us in the beef industry to work on the male fertility compared to the dairy is because of the database, right? So the dairy industry has the GHI that there is a lot of reporting, and they have millions of reports every year. The dairy industry, 90%+ of their breeding is through AI.
Right.
And so we have control of the sires. We know the sires. There is the reporting. So we have tons and tons of data coming back that allow us to look a lot better within the dairy. Sometimes we don't like it in the beef industry, the beef on dairy, and we think it's a too big of a competitor and it's going to change the market. But it's been really good for me on my side. Because of the beef on dairy, we start getting a lot of data reported on those beef bulls used on dairy cows, where we can actually start compiling data on fertility. And recently, actually, with one of my master's students that just graduated this summer, we're able to work with with actually select sires and get some semen with data back, where we had, I think, 13 bulls there with different fertilities, and we're looking at the metabolism of the sperm. So, as I said, I didn't expand much, but one of the big take homes of the proteomics was the change in metabolism between the sperm and the epididymis and ejaculated for the longevity of the sperm. So, we're looking back into the metabolites that's produced by the sperm to see how that impact sperm longevity and basically sperm fertility, right? But we know it's somewhat associated back to the longevity of that sperm and some other mechanism that may be directly associated to embryo development.
Okay. I'm going to take this a little different route for a second. So with this, do you have any correlation to nutrition? Of what bulls are being fed, whether it's before, during, or after these collections, and how that might be affecting it?
So that's a really good question. Yes. So I'm not lead PI on those, but I've been collaborating with Dr. Fontes out of University of Georgia. And we've been, Dr. Fontes has been looking into the overweight of bulls, right? So what that overweight or overnutrition, what is the impact of that on bull semen quality and potential fertility and actual fertility? She has some in vitro studies. And what we've been seeing, so we recently published a paper looking at subcutaneous back fat. So basically, through carcass ultrasounding, how much back fat was in the loin there of those bulls, and what is associated of that with semen quality. So we got data from the UT bull test and then the Georgia bull test. And we've had about 700 observations, if I'm not mistaken, there. So it's a good amount of bulls in that data set. And we saw that correlation between the back fat and normal sperm morphology. So the greater the back fat deposition, the lower the semen quality, and then more likely of those bulls to fail a BSE as they keep increasing back fat. We had bulls there that had back fat bigger than what we want them for slaughter. Just, and they're all treated the same. We have bulls there with far more than half an inch of back fat. So I mean, and they're all treated the same way, but we have a large percent of the population being small, right? So less than that. So it's
Right.
still, there is a huge variation there that is associated to the animal's genetic too, but that led us to some really good conversation within our bull test because we want to develop those bulls. We want to keep challenging them so we can compare them for what their carcass merit is and all that. But we are understanding that this has an impact on semen quality and ability of those bulls to actually pass their breeding sounds exam. But Dr. Fontes took this a step forward and continued working on this, and actually got experimentally mature bulls and put them on a high plane of nutrition, so making them gain weight, and half of those bulls to maintain weight. And even in mature bulls, so you're talking about yearling bulls first, now it's mature bulls. In mature bulls, they hit it about 60, 70 days, somewhere around their window of gain, and collect semen in the end. And there was minimal change in the semen quality of those bulls. That was very interesting. However, he used that semen to do in vitro fertilization. And the bulls that were overweighted actually had lower embryo production. So we're going beyond just seeing semen quality. So even when those bulls pass the breeding sounds exam, we are still seeing some impact later on that may impact on pregnancy rates. So the actual fertility of those bulls. They may be able to fertilize, but because of the extra damage that's happening to that sperm that is not visual through the normal BSE analysis or the normal analysis we're doing, we're still having negative impact and infertility of those bulls. And Dr. Fontes haven't published yet, but is working on publishing. We're seeing similar data on young bulls develop on that small versus a high plane of nutrition. So even though we don't want to skin bulls that won't be able to get their job done, we also don't want a bulls on the extreme of that. And if there is some more a little older studies coming, especially coming from Canada, which I think that if we think about climate relates a lot to South Dakota, right, on the colder weather, extended cold weathers and everything. Even then, where I've get that, and some people, oh, but I want my bulls overweighted because of the cold, because of the extra weather, so they can tolerate a little bit better. Well, when they look at and they have a couple thousand breeding sounds exam, bulls on that 5, 6, and 7 body condition score had a much higher passing rate compared to bulls on the 4 and 8 body condition.
Right.
So even on that situation where cold, so it's not just heat stress. That's kind of my take home from those studies. Even on an environment that it's a lot more mild external temperature wise, we're still seeing this. So there's a lot more to it. So proper nutrition to keep those bulls within that optimum range, probably around that 6, 6.5. That's probably what I'll shoot for. Is what we want for them for optimal fertility.
And with that, you had mentioned that these bulls were on a, gaining plane of nutrition for 60 days. So, even though, whether you're spring calving or fall calving, getting your bulls ready for the breeding season, kind of in that 60-day window. And we know that spermatogenesis takes about that period of time, right? So, maybe explain that a little bit and what type of things you might see. If there is some damage to, in like a weather event or something like that, that might cause them to fail a BSE, and then how long could it take for that to repair?
Absolutely. So when we're thinking about stress to the bull, right, we are always not only the bull, but thinking about the what is happening in the test, the machine there, right? It's basically a machine producing a sperm. And it's like a factory. Once you just ripped one section and that section keep moving forward, well, it is going to disrupt the end product, right? And if we disrupt the whole factory today and we have pieces being produced every day on all the different sections of the factory, well, everything producer from now on until the last piece get moved out of the factory will be impacted, right? Like you
Right.
said, if it takes 60 days from the first cell to be actually out, within those 60 days, if that impact can impact even the first cells, it may take up to 60 days after you finish that issue before a good sperm will be coming out, right? So we had some studies, no, not we, in the literature, we have some studies that actually what they did is they went there, collect semen from bulls. They were really good semen quality. And if I'm going to put numbers there, they're probably 85, 90% normal cells. And about 70% normal motility. So really, really good semen, really high standard semen. And they went there and insulated the testes of those bulls. So basically creating, simulating a heat stress on that. And about the first week, it was pretty much all good when they were collecting semen from those bulls. And the reason for that, like I said, we have the epididymis that stores semen for several days. So that those sperm are already there and ready. They're not really impacted by this. But as soon as that storage got depleted, we start seeing decrease in normal morphology and motility. And it went really low where the bulls failed and had minimal normal sperm. I think it went down to about 30. And about the 40 after that ensued, or 35, 40 after that ensued, it start kind of coming back up. But even after the end of the study, I think they collected semen for about 45 days, wasn't still to the level where they would pass a brain sounds exam, but it was getting better. So, I mean, thinking about this, the heat stress, that's kind of the curve we're thinking about. However, we have to think about stress is a stress, right? And cold stress can also impact things. And I don't know if Dr. Lacey Quayle, she's at North Dakota. She literally recently wrote an article with me about frostbite in the testes.
Okay.
And that's another one, right? So, on those cold, and we're getting to the point where we may start seeing this. And depending how bad is that cold, the frostbite in testes will impact how big is the impact we're going to see. So, you may not be even thinking about this. But it makes something happen now, impact that bull when you're testing it for your spring breeding, right? So, South Dakota, we get snow February, March, April sometimes, we may get a blizzard there. Okay, even when you're breeding in June, because of that, if we don't take care of it, it may impact. So, some of the good rule of thumb is like make sure that bulls are not on concrete. Or something, or wet ground, or things like that that will freeze overnight, and things like that, or they will be in direct contact, something really cold. So if you're in concrete, plenty of padding, straws or something where they can lay down, so the test, excuse me, the test is not going to be directly in contact to the floor, right? To avoiding
Right.
creating that frostbite. If that frostbite happened, it doesn't mean because it happens they will be dead forever. So it depends on the degree of that frostbite and what actually caused. So if it's a small frostbite, most likely they will be fine by spring breeding, especially if you're more than 60 days after that. Large frostbite, that's when you start having concerns. And if that frostbite caused a big scar where it would impact the exchanging temperature, now what happened is it's not really the frostbite that was the issue. But as you keep moving on, it'll cause a heat stress because the animal cannot control the temperature. And we want the testes to be somewhere about 3 degrees lower than the body temperature. But because of that scar, and if that scar impacts or cause adherence, so the testes stay adhered to the wall where it cannot move up and down, in the scrotum, that's another thing that could, again, cause issues with term regulation.
Okay. That's a good point because sometimes if we see that little bit of scar, not thinking that it's too much damage, but the hindrance of the movement of those testes can definitely have those long-term effects even into June because, I mean, we warm up in May, but we don't probably get really warm until, June or July. And our heat stress might be different than your heat stress too. But I think cold stress is a lot more critical. And with all of our bull sales going on in, November, December, January, February, March, we're kind of trying to take care of those, especially as seed stock providers. So providing a lot of bedding, fresh bedding if it does get snowed on, so that way it's still, insulating those. And a couple other things, to think about, kind of back to the nutrition mark. Maintaining them on that plan of nutrition is probably, like you said, just fine compared to ramping them up too soon. So that way they get too fat before we turn them out on the breeding herd.
Yeah, and I mean, maintaining bulls are actually, if you go to the SDSU extension, I use that a lot as a reference for me. Dr. Walker has a really good extension article or fact sheet there about a bull and maintaining bull and take care of bulls. I mean, I encourage anybody listen to this. If you want to know more about bulls and this, please go there because there's a lot of good information. And still today, sometimes I go back there and use that as a reference for me.
Awesome. Well, I'm glad we're still providing you some good information with our extension website. So it's always up there, like you said, for anybody to visit. So another question as we kind of maybe transition off of the marker side, when we're looking at a BSE, you had said previously that, some of these bulls pass a BSE just fine. There wasn't anything physical we could see. Kind of what's the next level of things that producers can do? Is it, multiple BSEs, or is it really just helping collect that data to make sure they are fertile with so many yearling bulls entering the market every year in our stud catalogs? What can we as producers do to find out the best bull to use for fixed time AI?
Absolutely. So I'm going to take a step back, Taylor, here, and let's talk a little bit more about the BSE, right? Because I've been saying BSE a lot, and a breeding sounds exam or a BSE encompass basically three phases. The first one is look at the physical soundings of that animal, making sure feet and legs are correct, the prepuce, eyes, mouth. Actually, bulls use their eyes a lot. Or during the breeding, and people sometimes don't realize that they use actually sights to detect those what we call the sexually active groups or sags. So females will start getting more active, they'll bundle up and start mounting each other, and the bulls will actually visualize that and go check and identify those through smell to which females are actually in heat so that they can go breed. Then they need their feet and legs so they can jump, right? So bulls with feet and leg issues, one of the biggest problem with those animals is they may go there and breed one or two or three cows, and then something hurt, and they feel a pain. And especially when you think about longevity of those animals, right? Get 2, 3, 4 year old, those things should get worse and worse and worse on those bulls with feet and leg issues. And the natural thing for somebody with a pain and to stop doing what caused you pain. And if what caused bull pain is mounting cows, guess what? He's going to stop doing it, right? So that's where important, really important to actually look at the whole bull. Another part that people sometimes keep doing a breeding sounds exam is actually palpating those bulls. And I have a funny story because we have our vet here in our group, an extension group. And when he got hired, he was doing breeding sounds exam on a producer. And that producer got the phone and directly called my department head and complained and say, "What kind of veterinarian did you hire? He's here preg checking my bulls." And that for me, that's really funny because one, he's not preg checking, he's actually palpating because there's all the sex organs in there. But it concerns me on the other side Because if he's never seen a veterinarian palpating his bulls during a breeding sounds exam, it means that his bulls were not actually didn't fully get what the test is supposed to get, right? So a full breeding sounds exam or a complete breeding sounds exam does involve all this. And then we move on to the test is where we're going to do scrotal circumference. And while you're doing scrotal circumference, you want to test the texture of those, which is kind of part of the physical, but since we are there, and the mobility, right? Like we were talking about before, we want those testes to be able to move up and down within that scrotum. We want the consistency of that testes and both testes to be about the same size, right? Not the, just the circumference. If they're not the same size, we may have some issues going on. And then finally, after the bull pass out this, that's when we're going to collect the semen. And during collection of semen, we also want to go back to the physical portion there because we want to see the prepuce when the bull exposed the penis, if the penis is all right, and all that is part of the physical during actual semen collection. And then after we collect the semen is when we do what most people consider is testing the bull, is just looking at the semen, right? And it's just one of the pieces of all this. And then we're going to look at the morphology of that sperm. So basically what we want is at least 70% of those sperm to have what we consider a normal morphology for the sperm. So if they had a bigger head, a smaller head, issues with the tail, or where the tail is attached, or no tails, it, several different defects, that means they're not normal, right? So basically we look for those problems within the sperm. And some of those are makes more impact on fertility than others. We're not going to get in much detail in there, but and then we look at motility. And the fun thing about motility, yes, some bulls will fail because of motility. But for example, in the past 5 years of data that I collect from the bull test at the UT, I had zero bulls failing because of motility. All of those bulls fail because of something else, either the physical portion, where we don't even collect semen if they have physical issues, or they have morphology issues. And the large majority will be morphology issues. So being very critical with the morphology, and sometimes it's harder for me to explain about the morphology. And the reason for that, well, the motility is good. What are we talking about, right?
Right.
And if we start thinking about this, well, that's the sperm is like a little machine that is taking that DNA very simplistically to deliver to the oocyte. And if there's any issue with the machine that is taking that DNA there, it may also impact the DNA that's being delivered
Sure.
or
That
impact
makes
the
sense.
ability of that machine to get to the point. So, yeah, it's swimming, but if it's not swimming the right way, or if it doesn't, it can't get to the where it's supposed to be, then it doesn't matter it's swimming, right? It needs to swim and actually be good to actually generate a pregnancy. So
So that's
another
how we talk about some progressive motility, right? Like, so we want it to be progressively moving forward is a good way. I've heard it explained that we need it to be swimming the right direction, not just in circles or anything
correct.
like that. And that's where kind of like the bent tails and things like that are a maturation issue, right? So
Yep.
maybe talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so there are the different issues, right, happening in different portions of that travel of the sperm from being produced. So, for example, usually head defects will happen within the testes during that sperm production. A lot of the tail defects happen during the epididymal transit as the sperm is maturing from after being released from the testes and going through the epididymis. That's some of those will be in the testes, but most of those, especially bent tails, coil tails, DMRs, so distal midpiece reflexes, most of those will happen in the epididymal transit before it gets to the bottom of the test there in the epididymis to be stored as an ejaculated sperm. Another one
Okay.
that is during that process will be the droplets. So proximal droplets is an issue. It is a little remaining of the cytoplasm. So if you think about a cell, to a sperm, a round cell to a sperm, it loses a lot of the cytoplasm, the fluid, and other things that is within that cell to be that sperm which has a head and a tail. So the droplet stays right there close to the head, and it slowly moves down until it falls off. So moving that is during the epididymal transit, and then falling off most of the time will be during ejaculation. So
Okay.
the distal droplet, actually, it got removed from being an issue because there, we don't have any literature saying that the distal droplet actually caused fertility issues. So the proximal droplet is the one that we are worried about. Okay. And so those are some of the issues there that we see and where they happen there. And another thing that producers sometimes don't understand when I try to explain, or not to understand, but it takes a little more conversation before we go. Most of those bulls are not infertile. Even the bulls that fail the BSE, they're not infertile. What do you mean? Well, they still get a couple cows pregnant. They're just not efficient. And if you think about efficiency in our system with a breeding season and trying to get most cows pregnant early on that breeding season, an inefficient bull actually is not going to do that job for us. And thinking about our industry, where 90+% of our beef cows are bred by natural service only, well, if we put a subfertile bull there, you're setting yourself to lose a lot of money. Yeah, you may end up with cows pregnant, but because of the cows getting pregnant later on your breeding season, they're going to calve late. Because they calve late, their calves are going to be lighter at weaning. So you're leaving
Right.
a lot of money on the table in a high market like this, where we're talking about $3 to $4 a pound, depending how heavy you wean those calves. It's a lot of money if you lose 20 to 40 pounds. Right? Well, 21 days, right? Estrous cycle. Put there 2 pounds a day. We're talking about 40 to 50 pounds because they didn't get pregnant first, get pregnant second cycle. 50 pounds, talk about $150. So
Right.
one cow that didn't get pregnant where it's supposed to because of the bull, you already paid the breeding science exam with that bull.
Exactly. Like you said,
So,
it's more than just the looking at the semen, starting out with the physical, but also looking at that semen and even the efficiency of his breeding. And we don't really have a great way to measure that. I think like libido obviously is important for bulls to be able to want to get out there and breed. We might see that differences, between spring and fall herds, a little bit just with the depending on where you're at in the country. Some bulls want to get out and breed at more at the springtime up here versus in the fall, like they're ready to be done, unless you're a strictly fall calving herd. So to kind of circle back around, just getting close to time here of, what's the most important thing for producers to take away from these fertility markers of whether it's on the natural service side or the AI sire side.
absolutely. So I think you hit a point really good now talking about libido. Libido is not part of that breeding science exam, but extremely important. And the only way to know if a bull has libido or not is watching that bull. So I always tell my producer, make sure the bull passes a breeding science exam. As soon as you turn him out with cows, watch him a little bit and see if he actually goes there and do the job. Look him maybe 1, 2, 3 days when you're expecting cows to come in heat. If you're only natural service, probably right away. If you're doing a cleanup AI, maybe you can wait a couple of days where your cows will start coming back in heat. You put wait 3, 4 days to put, or 10 days to put your bull in with your cows post AI. Wait another week or so, go there, but keep looking at that bull, making sure that bull is interested in going there and breeding cows. Because having good semen but not delivering, it's not going to help you either, right? And testing those bulls, I didn't mention before, but we want to test those bulls before each breeding season. Here, for me, it's very common for me to have producers that have fall and spring. And I tell them, you have to test those bulls at least twice a year. Because each time before you turn that bull in with any group of females, you want to test it. If you're boring bulls or leasing bulls, make sure you test it before you put in with your cows. And like we mentioned before, that is just a snapshot of the bull's fertility. It doesn't guarantee for us, unfortunately, that that bull is high fertility if he pass, But is the best way and only way we currently have to evaluate if that bull's fertile or not. So doing that, but then every year testing that bull, before each breeding season testing that bull, so that the consistency of that can help you. I mean, I can't stress more than looking at the current market prices, right? Losing a calf crop because your bull is infertile or extremely sub-fertile. That's a huge expense that even buying a new bull would be cheaper.
Right. And
So
do you think it's important to test your bulls at the end of the breeding season?
I
Just
wouldn't worry
because,
about it. No, I
right.
would now let him recover, right? Because he's been working. So he might be bad at the end of the breeding season, but especially if you're not going to use him until next year, he has plenty of time to recover. So maybe you want to test him earlier than 60 days, but I'll make sure that we're maybe closer having another test to make sure he's ready to go with the cows.
Right. If
From
you're
the
buying bulls off of a bull sale that are already tested, it's still a good idea to test them before you turn them out because you might be buying them in February and you're not turning them out till June. But yeah, I think some folks have maybe tried looking at them at the end of the season, but like we've said several times, it's just a snapshot of that day, what he's producing. It doesn't tell you what happened 60 days ago, and it doesn't tell you what's going to be, like you said, a year from now. So still could be good. I think for some insurance purposes, some people need to do those testings. And so making sure you're getting all the things looked at is important too.
yeah, and I know if you want to test after the breeding season, I would still give him about that 30, 60 days, get him to recover some condition because normal for them to lose body condition. Actually, we expect it for a bull that is actually working and you push them to what he's supposed to be working to actually lose body condition. That's a good sign that he was actually doing what he's supposed to, right?
Right.
You get a bull, you put him with a bunch of cows and the bull is fatter when he comes out than he went in. That's scary.
Yes, you might have been laying under the shade tree a little too long.
So on the fertility marker side, I mean, currently we don't have anything out there applicable right now. We're working on, and I'm hoping within a couple years we can have something else, but that is not going to be to replace the breeding sounds exam. Okay, so the goal is to add on so we can actually narrow down the bulls that are higher fertility or remove more of those subfertile bulls from the population so we can actually improve our pregnancy rates that way, right? So if you keep removing the tail end, we're more likely to have the top end of those bulls. On the AI side, I think we're closer because we have the ability to use fancier machines like flow cytometry and things like that to test those bulls and ejaculates, where on a field setting, it's a lot more complicated to do that type of testing. And it's a lot more expensive, right? When I'm producing hundreds and thousands of doses of a single bull to sell, it makes sense me investing a couple hundred dollars in extra analysis. Where if I'm putting a bull to breed 30, 40 cows, it may not make as much sense. Right. So is that, and maybe the feasibility of running those analysis. So we're still under investigation to what could we add on. But something to remember, and it's a very tricky portion there, if we find something that it help us select those higher fertility bulls, that means more bulls will fail, not less, right? Hopefully over time we improve fertility overall and we have more bulls passing or go back to the amount of bulls. But as a general rule, if I put another bar there that they have to cross, we're going to have more bulls failing. That's something that we have to understand. And a good take home that I tell all my producers about a BSE is your veterinarian who's testing your bulls is not taking the test. The bull is taking the test. So the bull fails. It's not your veterinarian that failed your bull. The bull failed the test, right? Like when you're in school and you get a bad grade, it's not the teacher that gave you a bad grade. You got a bad grade because you took the test. Right? So don't blame your veterinarian because the bull fails.
And there are some times that you can retest them, so like you said, if we start 60 days ahead of time, retest them in 30 days. If some of those droplets or things are gone at that point, he's going to be more fertile than he was before, and time will tell. So as we lead up into bull sale season, they, like you said, they might come tested, they might not, but keeping in mind that you have to do your homework on your herd bulls as well, and essentially kind of give them their own scorecard, right? Especially in the mature bull side, just because he was good last year doesn't mean he's good this year. But it's always a good idea to get the mature bulls tested ahead of time, so that way you know what you need to purchase, so it doesn't come turnout day and you're short a bull or two, because the profitability is getting cows bred on time and in a timely window. And even with one extra calf every year, that will definitely help pay for, a new herd bull rather than keeping something that might be subfertile, whether it was due to environmental issues, age, damage, things happen. They're, like you said, they're a machine. Like, they have to do the work, and they're doing a lot of it for you in a short period of time.
And right now is as best as ever to get rid of bulls that you don't like the same way like cows you don't like. We had a couple mature bulls that we call here in the experimental station that I work on, and we literally sold the bulls for more money than we actually paid when we bought them a couple years ago.
Nice.
Just the craziest the market it is right now, right? So you're making money out of those cold bulls. Yes, you're paying a lot of money on that new bull. But if you're replacing, you're probably not that dead right now. So even though the bull prices are a little higher, it's a good investment. It's still a good investment to go there and make wise decisions. Don't overspend. But I mean, it's a good timing to go there and find a good bull that to replace it if you have any bulls that are questionable or you don't like.
So with that, this has been Cattle HQ, headquarters for all things beef cattle, brought to you by SDSU Extension. Thank you for joining us, and until next time, eat beef.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Cattle HQ, brought to you by SDSU Extension, headquarters for all things beef. We invite you to visit extension.sdstate.edu for the latest beef information, as well as subscribe to the show on Spotify. You will also find show notes and resources from today's episode. Until next time, remember, success is not a goal, it's a byproduct.